The last investigator I met with at the GI Symposium was Dr. Joseph Tabernero, and to begin, he commented on the landmark trial demonstrating a survival advantage when nab-paclitaxel was added to gemcitabine in metastatic pancreatic cancer.
My perception, having been participating in the trial, but also being in the steering committee of this trial, is that first, the combination was really safe if the physicians follow the clear recommendations. On the other hand, it's very convenient for patients because it comes together with the administration of gemcitabine, so patients do not need to come more times to the hospital for these facilities. And actually, this is important because when we discuss potential options with patients, now that we have the data on FOLFIRINOX, for this combination, we don't need central devices, we don't need pumps, patients do not need to come twice just for having the administration and for retiring the pump. So basically, the treatment is really convenient. And when we come to the efficacy data, as mentioned before, the advantage that we have in overall survival and in progression-free survival, interestingly also, the increase in the response rate, pretty remarkable. Obviously, we have to build on this. Unfortunately, the prognosis of the species continue to be poor. But I think that this is a real major step moving forward in this setting. So, unfortunately, after the approval of gemcitabine, all the other options have been quite debatable, especially the introduction of capecitabine. The benefit for the combination was marginal, only observable at the time that we did a meta-analysis from several clinical trials, but not just one single treatment. I would say the same for erlotinib, although that this trial show a statistically significant benefit from a clinical point of view, the benefit was really marginal. That's why this drug has not been widely used worldwide. So the first data that was really very interesting was the data coming from the French group with FOLFIRINOX in comparison to gemcitabine. We all were really very excited with this data. But at the end, when we tried to treat the patients with this schedule, we did find that the schedule was not tolerable at all, even with recommendations that were described at the New England Journal Medicine publication. So basically what actually all the groups and all the physicians that have been treating patients with FOLFIRINOX have done is to reduce the dose, to cap the doses. And unfortunately, we don't have data that this is going to work in the same way. So all major centers have their own cohorts of patients being treated with modified FOLFIRINOX, with or without G-CSF support. And when you compare this data with the data on the phase 2 publication, it looks quite similar, but it's always difficult to compare phase 2 data with phase 3 data. So the perception that we all have is that FOLFIRINOX seems to be an efficacious chemotherapy schedule for these patients, but very difficult to administer. Patients complain a lot on side effects, also on the inconvenience of having a pump and having a central device for that. So I think that the combination of gem nab-paclitaxel actually is going to build very well on the backbone of gemcitabine, and probably new agents are going to be added to this combination. So my perception is that this is going to be one of the preferred treatment options in the next future for this population of patients.
Do you have any sense in terms of how the efficacy of FOLFIRINOX in perhaps a modified dosing might compare in terms of efficacy to NAB-GEM?
Well, actually, this is an excellent question, probably something that should be evaluated in a clinical trial. Unfortunately, you know, this is hard to do. The other important thing, so basically the FOLFIRINOX trial has been done in a cooperative group from France, basically from academic centers. And if you look at the data, actually, the population of patients that were included in the trial were quite fit in a way that the PS ECOG status was 0-1. Also, they had to be in very good conditions and have almost a normal morphological and liver function. And unfortunately, this is not the case for most of the patients with advanced pancreatic cancer. This is a disease that usually comes at a late age, elderly people with some comorbidities. So I think that probably the population, if you compare the population of the patients included in the FOLFIRINOX trial and in the GEM nab-paclitaxel trial, Probably the second one, it's more comparable to the real population that we have in the clinical setting. So I think that it would be nice to have comparative data, at least randomized phase two, but my perception is that this is going to be hard to produce.
So for practical purposes, you know, docs have to make decisions without perfect data. I'm kind of curious, if you had a perfectly fit PS0 younger patient who needed a response to be able to go to surgery, what would you use today? Assuming you could use whatever you want regulatory-wise.
Well, actually, if you look at the response rate with gem nab-paclitaxel is also remarkable. And importantly, in this trial, for a population of patients, there is evaluation with PET CT scan. I'm not saying that PET CT scan is going to be mandatory, but there is a good correlation between the early response by PET CT scans and the real response. So I do think that for this population of patients, actually, both options are really very good.
So another major story that's coming out of this GI cancer symposium is in gastric cancer, where finally we're seeing something other than a chemotherapeutic agent. It looks promising, ramucirumab, and I know you've been involved with that. Can you talk about, first of all, the mechanism of action, which I think is really interesting, and what we're learning in terms of the trial looking at this at this meeting?
Well, basically, this is a large phase 3 study that evaluated the effect of ramucirumab compared to placebo in the population of patients with advanced gastroesophageal cancer in the second-line setting. And the first thing is that ramucirumab is a monoclonal antibody directed to the ectodomain of the receptor of the BGFR2 receptor, so the receptor that usually is activated by the ligands, BGF. So it's a novel way to block the BGF pathway.
As opposed to, for example, Bev or VEGF trap, aflibercept, getting the ligand.
Absolutely. That's the key point of this compound. So basically, this compound blocks the receptor. So it doesn't matter whether the ligands increase because the receptor is blocked. So this compound had demonstrated signs of activity in the phase 1, phase 2 studies in colorectal cancer, gastric cancer, and even renal cell carcinoma. And that's why for the opportunity, the niche opportunity, it was decided to do this study in the second line setting. And actually, you have to realize that at the time this study was designed, we didn't have data on randomized phase 2, phase 3 studies of cytotoxic agents in the second line setting. Now we are all discussing whether this study could be done right now, because we do know from different studies that both irinotecan and taxanes are active in the second-line setting in gastric cancer patients, at least in terms of progression-free survival and overall survival. But at the time that the study was designed, there were no clear options in this setting, so that's why this study could be conducted, and unfortunately, this study has resulted positive. And I think that, you know, the data that it's going to be shown actually will show efficacy in this population of patients. So the question that we are going to have right now is whether we use ramucirumab in the second-line setting or we continue to use cytotoxic agents that we do see they have activity and they can be used in a compassionate use or even out of label, and this is something that is being used. But again, the message here is that we are going to have a new compound targeting the angiogenesis pathway that is active by itself in gastric cancer patients. So this is going to be an option. And especially it's going to be an important option for those patients that are really very sick, because as you know, patients with gastric cancer and advanced disease, when they progress to the first line setting, they are usually very sick. So in some instances, these patients cannot tolerate another cytotoxic agent. So this is going to be a major player, I guess.
In terms of efficacy of the single agent, were responses actually observed, or what were the numbers that were seen?
Basically, what we see is an increase in overall survival. So the signs of shrinkage of the tumor are really very marginal. But this is what we would expect for an anti-angiogenic agent. I mean, all anti-angiogenic agents target the BGF pathway in solid tumors, except for renal cell carcinoma, usually produce disease control and increase in progression-free survival and overall survival, but not really major responses.
So, I mean, in terms of, you know, for example, Bev and aflibercept, a lot of the trials have looked at chemo plus those agents with the thought there's a synergy. What about chemo plus ramucirumab?
Well, this is a concept that is being evaluated in other tumor types, for example, in colorectal cancer. So the data in colorectal cancer coming from phase 1 and phase 2 studies in first and second line setting, both in combination with FOLFOX or FOLFIRI, suggested that in terms of response rate, but especially in terms of progression-free survival, the combination was active and also was feasible from a safety point of view. And there is a major ongoing study, phase 3 study, in the second line setting, that is going to address this question. Because very interestingly, this study is designed for patients that have clearly progressed to the first line treatment consisting in FOLFOX with bevacizumab. So this study being conducted in the second line setting clearly will address the question whether FOLFIRI plus or minus ramucirumab it's going to be offering an advantage in overall survival in this setting.
Based on the data that we have right now from this monotherapy study, do you think this is enough to get it approved?
For gastric cancer, I think so. I mean, again, from a regulatory point of view, at least in Western countries and in the US, this is going to be the only study that has the power from a regulatory point of view to get the approval of a drug. So the drug is going to be there. And I think that for most of the patients, this would be an important option in the second-line setting. Even for some others, it may be used more in the third-line setting, but definitely this drug is going to be an important option.
And what was seen in terms of toxicity, typical VEGF stuff?
Well, the toxicity actually is related to the BGF pathway inhibition, and to be honest, it clearly shows that this compound inhibits the BGF pathway because we did have hypertension, we did observe also proteinuria. So all the side effects related to the BGF inhibition, very manageable, we have to say, but they were there.
So let's talk a little bit about colorectal cancer, a lot to talk about there. And maybe we can begin by, I'm curious about your thoughts right now, since ASCO and last year, all the data we saw with Bev Beyond Progression with the TML study, as well as the aflibercept and the Valor study. Can you sort of comment on what your takeaway was from those data and how it's affected your practice?
Well, basically, the compilation of the data that evaluated different anti-angiogenic treatment options in the second-line setting suggest and show that continuation of inhibition of angiogenesis in the second-line setting translated to a benefit in the survival of these patients. We could discuss whether the magnitude of this effect is really important or not. And to be honest, for the time being, this is hard to say, and I think that it's really debatable in a way that, you know, for example, in the TML study that wanted to be a really a pragmatic study allowing all chemotherapy schedules, both in the first line, second line, the inclusion criteria were really very clear in terms of patients that really progress in the first line setting under bevacizumab. But on the contrary, the fact that being a pragmatic study allows for several chemotherapy options, it dilutes a lot the effect on specific chemotherapy options. And we do know that, you know, from other studies, for example, the 966 study, not all the chemotherapy schedules are going to benefit in the same way by the addition of a targeted agent. We do know that for bevacizumab, also for cetuximab. So for me, it's really more important to have large numbers and clear data on a specific chemotherapy schedules. Otherwise, you know, we may be confused on the real magnitude of the effect of a particular chemotherapy treatment. So, and in this regard, the Valor study, actually it's a clean study in a way that all patients were treated with FOLFIRI, second-line setting. One-third of the population actually had been treated with bevacizumab in the first-line setting. So the magnitude may be quite similar to the magnitude of the effect of bevacizumab, but my perception is that the consistency of the data in terms of efficacy is superior by the design of the study. Obviously, we can discuss on the side effects. And aflibercept being a compound that targets several ligands at the same time, BGF-A, BGF-B, and especially PLGF, this is associated with more side effects than bevacizumab in the second-line setting. And interestingly, some of the side effects were difficult to understand for us at the beginning because the functions of PLGF are not well known. But now we know that PLGF plays an important role in the bone marrow cells, and this may explain, at least in part, why these patients had more neutropenia and hematological side effects compared to the control arm with chemotherapy alone.
I've heard it said, actually, I'm thinking Eric von Kutzum mentioned this when I spoke to him about it. His feeling was that in some way the aflibercept might be accentuating chemotoxicity. Is that the way you can say? I see you had a meta-analysis. You're part of a meta-analysis looking at aflibercept toxicity. What did you see there? And do you agree that it's kind of somehow increasing chemotoxicity, at least myelosuppression?
I think so, but the mechanism is potentially different in a way that targeting PLGF may have other on-class side effects. But you're right. I mean, in all clinical studies where aflibercept has been added to conventional chemotherapy, usually neutropenia increases. And this is consistent within the different trials.
So actually, I just noticed on my phone coming over here that the FDA today approved bevacizumab on disease progression, which I thought was kind of interesting. Any thoughts about practically making the decision in the second line setting between continuing Bev and aflibercept?
Well, actually, this is going to be one of the more challenging decisions that we're going to have. I think that both options are feasible, and we have to take the decision based on the data that we have, depending on the chemotherapy schedule that we use. As mentioned before, I do think that in order to take decisions, we have to take, you know, in clear discussion, the data that we have for each particular chemotherapy schedule and each particular clinical situation, right? So the message is that both options are feasible. The pattern of toxicity, if we take into account all the data that we have coming from TML, but also from the ECOG 3200 study, seem really that bevacizumab in the second-line setting is manageable, either it has been administered in the first-line setting or not. For aflibercept, we're still trying to elucidate how to manage some of the side effects. But I think that what is going to be important in these agents is whether we can figure out if there is any population that may benefit more from the treatment. Because the treatment is clearly effective, but would have expected that it would be more effective for the two agents, both bevacizumab and aflibercept. And at least what I can tell you is that for the aflibercept study, there is a major interest of collecting all the blocks worldwide of the primary tumors and try to look at different potential biomarkers that eventually may be predictive of activity if we can figure out this and try to divide the population that may better benefit from one treatment and the other. Obviously, this is going to take some time. It's not something that we are going to have during this year, but hopefully this is going to be hypothesis-generating data, and eventually, in the next future, we'll be able to design studies just trying to look at different populations of patients.
In trying to look at the comparative toxicities of, let's say, aflibercept chemo versus Bev chemo, I guess one of the issues is in the TML study, the patients had already gotten Bev, so they kind of were self-selected out to be able to tolerate it. Do you think that if you compared patients who had already gotten Bev, that the toxicity of aflibercept wouldn't be as much as what it appears to be?
Well, we look at that in detail. In the 30% of patients that had received Bev in the first-line setting, naturally, the toxicities that are BGFR-related and BGFR-unrelated were quite similar. So basically, we have learned a lot on how to treat BGFR inhibition-related toxicities. And for the time being, it's really very unusual to see a patient that has to stop a treatment with a BGFR inhibitor based on that the patient has grade 4 hypertension with encephalopathy or grade 3 proteinuria. So this is not something that we usually see. But obviously there are some patients that are going to have still this kind of toxicities.
What about the patient who progresses through first-line chemo-Bev? Are you thinking about continuing Bev and adding another chemo or thinking more about aflibercept since it's a slightly different mechanism?
Both options, as mentioned, are good options. But if we look at the data that we have on aflibercept, interestingly enough, one important and remarkable thing is that it doubled response rate from around 10% to 20%, roughly. And I think that this is especially important because we do know that in the Tiemann study, response rate was similar and was quite low. Probably it was low because, as mentioned, one of the points is that it allowed for different chemotherapy schedules, some of them conventional, some others unconventional. And, you know, when you treat patients with different schedules, even sometimes at cap doses, the maximum effect of the cytotoxic agents is not achieved. This may be one potential reason for that. On the other hand, with full dose FOLFIRI with a aflibercept, actually we had response rate out of 20% independently review. So, I mean, what does it mean? Actually, the message from here is that if you have a patient in the second line setting that has either lots of symptoms due to the tumor burden or has a rapidly progressive disease, perhaps this combination may offer more advantages because we do know that there is an important shrinkage of the tumor. On the other hand, for those patients that do not have symptoms or mild symptoms, probably the two options are recommendable.
So another piece of the colorectal cancer puzzle that came out this year, and again, you were very involved with this, was regorafenib and the CORRECT trial. Can you comment on what that looked at, how regorafenib works, and again, how you see it fitting into clinical practice?
Well, regorafenib, actually, it's an interesting compound because it's quite what we call a promiscuous compound. So basically, it targets several receptors. So the BGFR family receptors, 1, 2, 3, also c-KIT, PDGFR, RET, marginally FGFR. And we do know that all these receptors are really important in the colorectal cancer homeostasis, and especially in the late stage when other angiogenic pathways have been inhibited, because one of the mandatory criteria for this trial is that patients had to have received all available drugs, and this means saliplatin-based, irinotecan-based, bevacizumab, and EGFR inhibitors if the patient had KRAS, wild-type tumors. So this is a time where patients have received all these type of treatments and the tumors have become resistant. So this means that several different pathways are activated. And in this situation, a compound like this that could inhibit at the same time different receptors could have the opportunity to slow the progression of the disease. And basically, from this study, we know that the response rate is marginal, but there is a clear disease control by the treatment when this study was conducted, comparing this treatment with placebo. And again, for this very late stage, this compound offers another opportunity to this population of patients that are usually very sick. Usually, they do not like or they do not prefer to receive more intravenous treatments. So an oral treatment can be really of help in order to prolong survival of these patients. This does not mean that this compound has no toxicity at all. We do know that kinase inhibitors, especially if they are promiscuous, can have toxicity. And actually, this is the case of regorafenib, although it was developed with a schedule that had some days off treatment. But probably one of the future challenges that we have is how to deal with these side effects in this patient population, whether we have to reduce the dose as soon as possible if we see these side effects, whether we have to develop other more discontinuation schedules, like, for example, 1 week off, 1 week on, or 10 days on, 4 days off, something like that. This has been actually explored in combination studies with chemotherapy and maybe a potential opportunity for this compound. But I do think that we still have need to elucidate a little bit more how to deal with the side effects. Interestingly, what it's going to be presented is that for the conventional biomarkers that we look in colorectal cancer, meaning especially KRAS, but also BRAF mutations, we don't see any population that benefits more than the other. And actually, it makes sense because these biomarkers are related to the signaling pathways of the malignant cells. And basically, here, we are mainly inhibiting the stroma with the receptors that I have mentioned before. So the good message is that from a perspective of new drugs, actually inhibiting the angiogenesis pathway, we have the continuation of bevacizumab in second line, we have aflibercept, we have regorafenib, that partially it's an angiogenic inhibitor, and also we have the other compound, ramucirumab, that is being developed also in colorectal cancer. So basically we are going to have several drugs inhibiting the angiogenesis process.
So what's been seen specifically in terms of the type of toxicity? I know that it's chemically very similar to sorafenib. Do you see hand-foot syndrome?
We do see hand-foot syndrome. Fortunately, we know better how to treat and how to prevent a little bit these side effects. So we have learned a lot all these years treating patients with sorafenib and sunitinib. One important toxicity that some patients actually complain is asthenia or fatigue. And this is going to be, I think, probably the more relevant toxicity that we'll have to deal with these patients. Some others have some kind of liver toxicity, but also in this late stage situation, sometimes the liver toxicity is seen like a situation of the evolution of the disease rather than treatment related. But basically what most of the patients actually complain is on asthenia or fatigue.
You know, a lot of novel agents cause asthenia and fatigue. Any thoughts about why?
Well, actually, this is the case, especially for multi-targeted agents. So on one hand, abrogating the signal induced by different receptors and downstream proteins, it's a good way to treat the disease. On the other hand, you may be inducing some side effects, and at the end, you don't know who is the ultimate responsible for this side effect.
Any situations where you could see using regorafenib earlier, for example, before an EGFR antibody?
I think that this is an excellent question. Unfortunately, this has not been evaluated. Whether it's used before or after EGFR inhibitors, I mean, from a regulatory perspective, we should use this after EGFR inhibitors. But I think that this is a question that we have to discuss with patients, also related to the side effects and the intention of treatment. Because if the intention of treatment in this late stage is to prolong survival and progression-free survival, and the patient has the chance to receive all the treatment options, I would feel comfortable to discuss whether I use first the EGFR inhibitor or regorafenib. But for me, another interesting area where a compound like regorafenib may show a benefit is in the maintenance treatment. So patients actually complain a lot, especially in the first-line setting, where they receive active treatments for 9, 10, 11, up to 15 months sometimes. And actually coming the patients to the hospital day facilities on an every 2-week basis for conventional chemotherapy plus targeted agents sometimes make them feel quite miserable in terms of the obligations that they have with the hospital. And more, especially in academic environments, we are discussing whether there could be other approaches to maintain the effect of the induction that has been produced with chemotherapy and a targeted agent. And I think that it's more and more important now that we have this type of drugs approved in colorectal cancer, try to set up these drugs in different places where actually the patients could have more benefit, like these maintenance policies.
I see that you've been involved in some work looking at colaprint. And I'd like to hear what you have to say about that, as well as the Oncotype test in the adjuvant setting for colon cancer.
So basically, what we presented at the last ASCO GI meeting was a confirmation on how the colaprint prognostic signature works in patients with mainly stage 2, but also stage 3 colon cancer. And actually, what we did in this study was to compare the data that the signature by itself produces and provides to the physician and the patient, but also to compare how this data relies on the classification of poor risk or good risk by the ASCO criteria. And we did show that for the colaprint signature, the signature was independent, so it was of additional benefit. And actually, in the multivariate analysis, this was the most predictive factor. Even if we consider MSI status, the signature continued to be really very predictive. And now what we are doing is validating this signature that originally was done with frozen specimens, with fresh tumors, in paraffin and BEV materials. And I think that, I mean, this is going to be really very helpful, like the Oncotype, but with different scales. Basically, the differences for the Oncotype signature for colon cancer and the colaprint is that the colaprint divided the population of patients in only two groups, one of high risk and one of low risk, and also compare the data produced by the signature with the clinical characteristics. And this is a little bit different with the Oncotype. But we are actually presenting this year, building on the field of genomic platforms, is a pivotal study trying to address whether the gene signatures could help us to define different populations of patients with colorectal cancer based on the genes that are either upregulated or downregulated, based on the mutations these tumors have, also based whether there is an epithelial mesenchymal transition phenotype or not. And at least we have been able to find three different groups of patients with completely different characteristics according to the gene profile.
So at least taking the model from breast cancer where the Oncotype has been used now extensively, because it seems to have some predictive value in that situation. Haven't seen too much of that in colon cancer, but at the last ASCO, there was an interesting presentation that looked at specimens from the NSABP-C07 Oxali trial, where the Oncotype looked like it predicted who benefited from Oxali. What did you think about that?
Well, actually, this is the first step for the Oncotype. We are also doing the same. So basically, that study that was presented at ASCO was done with the C07 samples. In order to have a validation of this, we are collecting the samples of the MOSAIC study, the original pivotal study with full FOTS, and trying to do the same. And actually, this is going to be very important. If we can validate that the Oncotype signature is predictive for the benefit of the addition of oxaliplatin, this is going to be a major finding in order to avoid neurological toxicity for those patients that are not going to benefit from the treatment. This is one way to do. The other way to do that we are evaluating in the adjuvant setting is whether 3 months of treatment with oxaliplatin-based chemotherapy is good enough compared to 6 months of treatment. And this is being done in different clinical trials, large clinical trials of up to 9,000 patients, some of them. And in one worldwide collaboration that it's called IDEA collaboration, basically is managed under the umbrella of the Mayo Clinic and Dan Sargent. And this is going to be also very important because we administer chemotherapy for 6 months, but we don't know whether 3 months could be good enough.
Do we know from those trials or other data how much of a difference it makes in terms of neurotoxicity to use 3 as opposed to 6 months?
Well, actually decreases grade 3 and grade 2 toxicity. And to be honest, if you look at the academic centers where patients that receive oxaliplatin-based chemotherapy are managed according to the guidelines before any new infusion, they are completely explored for neuropathy. At the end, you realize that the median number of cycles with oxaliplatin that are administered are between 8 and 11. And if you consider 8, it's almost 6, that it's what we are exploring. And again, even you administer only 8 or 9 cycles, unfortunately, there is a small proportion of patients that are going to have grade 3 toxicity or grade 2 toxicity for a really prolonged period of time. So basically, these studies are going to help us to provide meaningful information whether 3 months is enough, and then we should stop the treatment, rather to give this option at the discretion of the physician and the patient, because sometimes it's very difficult to score this kind of toxicity. And unfortunately, some patients actually have residual grade 3 or grade 2 neurotoxicity for several years.
Yeah, I mean, that would be a major step forward in terms of quality of life for patients if you could eliminate oxali or shorten the amount of oxali. And in that regard, you were part of the recent report on the follow-up for the MOSAIC trial, and it's kind of looking like the benefit there is kind of maybe not as great as we hoped it was going to be long-term.
Well, we have a benefit, actually, for survival. The situation is that, basically, in this particular trial, also in the C07 study, it seems that patients that are older than 70 years old do not benefit from the treatment, or the benefit is really very marginal. And this is in opposition, for example, with the data that has been presented with another approach that was with other centers developed, and this is the combination of oxaliplatin-capecitabine. So in that particular trial, the so-called Shelots trial, Even patients that were older than 70 years old benefit from the treatment. Obviously, the magnitude was not the same, neither for disease survival nor for overall survival, but the trend was very similar to the younger population. And actually, this is not the case for oxaliplatin 5-fluorouracil. Whether there is any confounding factor by the use of capecitabine in one study and the use of 5-fluorouracil in the other studies, we don't know the real answer for that. But this is really important because you have to realize that colorectal cancer, actually, it's a disease of the elderly population. And you can see that in clinical trials, usually we include patients that are younger than the real life. And actually, you and other authors are presenting data on the use of oxaliplatin in this setting and the use of adjuvant therapy in this setting. And I think that at the end, it's very important to see what is really being used in the conventional care of patients in the real practice rather than what we have in clinical trials and try to answer questions that real patients have.
Yeah, and you know what we saw there, as you might guess, at least the U.S.-based study, there is a lot of oxali being used. What struck me was a lot in stage 2 and a lot in stage 3 older patients over the age of 70. In what situations do you use oxali yourself in stage 2 disease right now?
Actually, I use oxaliplatin-based chemotherapy after a discussion with a patient, so that's for sure. You always do that even in stage 3, but especially in stage 2. So if the patient actually has a poor risk tumor, I tend to use more oxaliplatin-based chemotherapy, even in stage 2, for several reasons. First, because the real poor risk patients with stage 2, actually the disease-free survival that they have is really very low. So a T4 patient actually has a poor survival compared to patients with N1, T3, or N1, T2 tumors. But the study that we did in our institution and also in other institutions at the preclinical level clearly show that those cells that are deficient in the mismatch repair genes are more sensitive to irinotecan-based chemotherapy.